So the point is that it's about that perfect message from the perfect God being conveyed by the perfect person.
May we all be worthy enough to follow the
Inshallah.
True prophet of Islam and his religion. Thanks again for joining us. Until next time.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With the light.
It's a joyous festive mood in East Asia as the region welcomes the Lunar New Year with celebrations, including light and lantern decorations of homes and public avenues. People across China are staging a variety of events to mark the New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. Several cities have held breathtaking light shows, with many landmarks and skyscrapers dazzling with colorful images. In the capital, Beijing, the light shows feature elements of the Winter Olympics as the city is getting ready to host the International Games this week. Elsewhere, Malaysians welcome the Year of the Tiger with an underwater lion dance performance in an aquarium in the capital, Kuala Lumpur. The citizens have welcomed the return of the annual event, which had been called off the previous year due to COVID-19 restrictions.
A lot happier as compared to during the lockdown period where you're alone and you do things alone. You feel very lonely, right? Now that you get to be in touch with your family, yeah, it's a lot better.
Even though we still keep the social distance, but however, I feel the freedom to go out and visit and do the things that I like to do.
Celebrations are also underway in Hong Kong, Taiwan and Indonesia. The Lunar New Year, seen as a time of reunion and rebirth, is celebrated by more than 2 billion people worldwide, especially amongst Asian communities. The festivities last for over a fortnight.
Stunning light shows and hanging lanterns have illuminated cities across China to welcome the new Lunar Year, also called the Spring Festival. The city of Zigong has taken the spotlight with a sea of lanterns, turning it into a scene straight out of a fairy tale. The city is famous for lantern making and brings a festive mood this time around every year. The lanterns are usually made in all kinds and shapes, including legendary creatures representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, which is decorated vividly on special couplets. The New Year festivities officially begin on Tuesday and will continue for 15 days. The Lunar New Year is considered the largest migration of people in the world, as millions travel back to their towns and villages to mark the event.
Sub-zero temperatures in the Midwestern U.S. haven't held anglers back from participating in the world's largest charitable ice fishing contest. Some 10,000 people from across the world gathered in the state of Minnesota to put their ice fishing skills to test. They dug thousands of holes in Gull Lake in a matter of hours. Some $200,000 in prizes were up for grabs in the contest. The volunteer-led annual event has so far raised about $4 million for 67 charities since it was first held in 1991. Beryl Carr is a special volunteer at a hospital in London. What makes her special, you might wonder? Well, the fact that she celebrated her 100th birthday last month. Carr has been volunteering in Ealing Hospital for more than 18 years. She works in the hospital's cafe and says her work is her lifeline. This incredible 100-year-old lady says she enjoys helping those who are not as fortunate as she is and that she has no intentions of retiring. The hospital staff say her presence has been very motivating.
Many of us look at her. She's always got a smile on her face, a swagger as she walks. And you come back from a clinic or a ward round, you're absolutely tired, and she just inspires you as soon as you see her.
Even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped Carr from volunteering. Born in a nearby town, Carr says she moved back to the neighborhood more than two decades ago after the death of her husband. When asked about the secret to her long and healthy life, she refused to answer, saying she's not planning on revealing that secret. A surprise in a Chinese zoo ahead of the Lunar New Year. 15 rare golden tigers make debut in front of excited fans. A large group of visitors gathered in China's Yellow River Delta Zoo to watch the rare animals. This zoo is the largest breeding base for golden species of tigers across China. The animals are being strictly protected amid fears surrounding their extinction. The golden tigers are a variant of Bengali tigers with rare color variations, including black strips. They are no longer extant in the wild.
The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately a million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope. The streets in the Taiwanese capital are decorated vividly to welcome the Year of the Tiger beginning on February the 1st. Residents are using tiger sculptures and totems to adorn the streets of Taipei. Shops are booming as people head out to buy special couplets ahead of the new year, also called the Spring Festival. Many are hoping they can completely defeat COVID-19 this year, as celebrations were scaled down due to the pandemic last year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated by almost 2 billion people across the world, though mainly in Asia. There are 12 animals representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, a symbol of strength and power.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The National Zoo in Washington is now home to a new quill-covered resident, the second offspring of a porcupine family. Zoo staff reported the birth of the porker pet earlier this month during a snowstorm. They say they are awaiting a DNA analysis to reveal more information about the baby porcupine. Its brother is now 4 years old. The two siblings are the fourth generation of this family to live in the zoo's mammal house. These animals are born with the ability to climb and look almost identical until they are 6 months old. Natives of South America, these creatures are one of the 18 porcupine species that exist in the world today. The house in Colombia has become a hotspot for tourists. It's built in a unique way, and if you want to enter the house, you have to first walk on the ceiling leading to the door. The upside-down house is named Casa Loca and is located in Guatavita, a short distance from the capital, Bogota. Tourists can be seen walking around taking pictures of this exceptional structure. Many say it fills them with joy to visit such places. Some tourists say this has provided them a chance to gain momentum, some relief from the struggles of the pandemic.
We've come from a pandemic. We've emerged from a lockdown. So this helps people have a moment of relaxation with the novelty that we did not have. You have fun while snapping photos. It puts your mind at ease.
The Austrian creator of Casa Loca says he first got the idea to build a house when he was visiting a similar place in his country back in 2015. He says his grandchildren were stunned by the creation, and that's why he decided to make an upside-down house in Colombia, where he lives now. He says people initially thought he was mad, but he decided to accomplish his plan anyway. The pandemic slowed him down a bit, but he proudly inaugurated the place 3 weeks ago.
Iran has won the first title in team category of the 20th Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championship. Saman Kujuri has more.
Talented Iranian children have ranked first in team category of the 20th Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships, which was held online. Children in five different age groups, including age 5 to 7 as Group A, 8 to 9 Group B, 10 to 11 Group C, 12 to 14 Group D, and 15 or older in Group E, annually attend the contest solving multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square roots, cube roots, fractions, time, and etc. 572 students from 21 member states participated at the event.
This year, Iranian students have won the title of Champion of the Champions in two categories. Moreover, they won titles in all categories, including Champion of Champions titles, Champion titles, First Winners, and the Second Winner titles. In 2023, Iran will host the 22nd edition of the Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships.
The Smart Kids Institute holds a national competition annually in August to select members of the Iranian team for attending the PAMA Global Abacus Championships. Children from 17 to 13 years of age take part in the competition to solve some 7 mathematical test sheets using abacuses.
I am 12 years old. I have won the first title in this round of the international competitions. I have been practicing with abacus for 4 years. In the competitions, we had to solve multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, and etc.
My math teacher encouraged me to learn abacus 5 years ago. Abacus and mental arithmetic skills had great impact on my mental growth and helped me a lot in my math lessons.
The championship, organized by a non-profit organization established in 1999, is an example of what can be achieved with early intervention in abacus math and mental arithmetic education.
The purpose of the competition is to allow for observation of mental arithmetic skills from countries around the world and to promote related education to find new talents in this field. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Traveling around the world is a wish a lot of people have, but never actually get the chance. However, the Belgian-British girl has achieved that feat at only 19. Zora Rutherford flew back home on Thursday to a crowd made up of family members, friends, fans, and journalists. She completed her odyssey after just over 5 months, traveling over 52,000 kilometers. Zara is the youngest female in the world to fly around the globe. She achieved this using a microlight aircraft, which weighs only 325 kilograms and has very low fuel consumptions. That's absolutely amazing. Let's take a listen.
Right, the plane obviously is a bad for the environment. I'm not trying to claim that it is. But I have chosen one of the best aircraft to do it with. The fuel consumption is amazing. For this whole trip, it's used the same amount of fuel as a Boeing uses in about 10 minutes. for the whole trip of around the world, which I think puts things into perspective. Obviously, it is bad, but I'm really trying to minimize my impact as much as possible.
Zara says the scariest part of her trip was flying over the frozen expanse of Siberia, a place with no human habitation close by. The teen adventurer also had to deal with different countries' health restrictions. Zara had to take multiple PCR tests on her journey, while China's COVID-related regulations meant she could not use the country's airspace. Now, Zara says she is glad she can stay in one place for a few months. Who knows what her next adventure will be?
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Nominating Supreme Court justices has always been about identity and politics. It's just that for nearly the first two centuries of the court's existence, the only people considered for inclusion were white men. The article you're about to hear has been written by Charles Blow, an opinion columnist for the New York Times. The piece is titled, When All White Was All Right. Nominating Supreme Court justices has always been about identity and politics. It's just that for nearly the first two centuries of the Supreme Court's existence, the only people considered for inclusion were white men. When it comes to power, white and male are silent, like the U in disguise. In this country, white men are the presumptive base of power from which everyone else is a deviation. They are the norm against which all others are judged to be anomalous. When white men were the only people being considered for seats on the Supreme Court, qualifications didn't always matter. James Francis Burns dropped out of school at the age of 14 and never went to college or law school. What he knew of the law, he learned from working at law firms before he was admitted to the South Carolina bar and started his own practice. His lack of any formal higher education didn't prevent President Franklin Delano Roosevelt from appointing him to the Supreme Court. He served for a little over a year before he quit. He later became the Secretary of State under President Harry Truman. Some justices, like John Archibald Campbell, enslaved Africans. John Archibald Campbell would side with the majority in the horrendous Dred Scott case. In 1861, he resigned from the court, and the following year he joined the Confederate government as its Assistant Secretary of War. Not all of white men who served on the court were paragons of morality. Not all of them went to college, let alone law school. But they each had the golden ticket: low melanin and high testosterone. So now, it is fascinating to watch as people work themselves into conniptions about Joe Biden committing to choosing a Supreme Court nominee from a group that has long been overlooked: black women. It is identity politics and affirmative action, they scream. Ben Carson said on the Vince Coglianese show that Joe Biden's pledge to choose a black woman was a sign that we've reverted back to identity politics and that it would bring more division into our country. Ben Carson hoped, he said, that people could be incensed about it. In the end, he called it abominable. As Carson explained it, we need a Supreme Court where we have the best candidates. This from one of the most unqualified secretaries of housing and urban development the country has ever had, a man who didn't even know the basics of his job. When Representative Katie Porter asked him at a congressional hearing if he knew what an REO was, the initials stand for real estate owned, a term used to describe property that has failed to sell at a foreclosure auction, Ben Carson seemed to think she was referring to an Oreo cookie. Even after Katie Porter clarified the three letters, Carson was still left guessing what the O stood for, at one point suggesting real estate e-organization. This from a man who Donald Trump may have nominated to the post only because of Trump's own constant problematic conflation of black with urban, even though most black people in this country live in the suburbs. The irony here is that Ronald Reagan, the Republicans' patron saint before the rise of Donald Trump, made a similar promise in 1980 when he was in trouble with women for not supporting the Equal Rights Amendment. Reagan promised to nominate a woman. Again, the word white was silent, and that's how we got Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Carson wasn't the only conservative making a fuss about Joe Biden and identity politics. Tucker Carlson also railed against the impeding pick, saying, "Biden claims that his race counting is essential so that the court and the rest of his administration, quote, looks like America." He continued, "Of all the lies that Joe Biden tells, this could be the easiest to check. We have the latest census numbers, and we can promise you with dead certainty that Joe Biden's nominees look nothing like America. Not even close." Instead, Tucker Carlson said a black woman nominee will represent about 7% of the population. I say, look at it another way. Of the 115 Supreme Justices who have served on the bench since 1789, 108, or roughly 94%, have been white men. 0% have been black women. Viewed this way, through the long sweep of American history, the United States has some work to do. There is no legitimate or logical argument against inclusion. Consciously including racial groups can be one of the most effective reparative remedies for centuries of racial exclusion. Only when we disentangle the concepts of whiteness and maleness from the concept of power can we see the damage the association has done. Only then can we truly accept and celebrate the power of inclusion, diversity, and equity. Only then can representative democracy in a pluralistic society begin to live up to its ideals.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a program that aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region which affect the governments, organizations, and especially the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and provide you with some external perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will take a deep insight into the plight of Rohingya refugees in India. Does the country need a change in its existing law to adjust those fleeing persecution in their country of birth? And we will discuss why Hindu hardliners want to sideline Mahatma Gandhi, often insulting and questioning his status as the father of nation and his legacy of communal harmony.
Traitor, anti-Hindu and pro-Muslim are the words India in general and the world in particular have come across time and time again from the Hindu hardline right against none other than Mahatma Gandhi. Now, they have become vocal enough to use abusive language against him while describing Gandhi's assassin, Natoram Godse, as a patriot. Many right-wing Hindu leaders never mince words when it comes to criticizing Gandhi, but it's backfired this time, triggering outrage and leaving right-wing organizations with umbilical ties to the BJP government embarrassed.
Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, addressed as Mahatma, meaning the revered one, is not only a freedom fighter, but a social and economic revolutionary. His idea of non-violence or passive political resistance against the then colonial rule is praised and followed all over the world. This multicultural, multi-ethnic country became a nation-state owing allegiance to one constitution, one flag, and one government only on August 15, 1947. But India achieving the milestone was never possible without popular movements and sacrifices made by freedom fighters. Gandhi, who actually started his anti-colonial mission in South Africa, became a force to reckon within the early 20th century. His decades-long movement, or Satyagraha, began against the plight of Indian planters and continued until Quit India, a movement in which he gave a call for the British to leave the country. So it seemed to a vast millions of Indians and who saw a father figure in him. But right-wing Hindu elements continue to question the father of nation, a title conferred upon Mahatma by the Constitution of Free India. As the new India is emerging, so the rhetoric and derogatory remarks by far-right ideologues, just like the one happened recently when a so-called Hindu monk used abusive remarks against Gandhi and glorified the one who assassinated him in 1948.
Police came into action against Hindu religious leader Kalicharan Maharaj after a video from a religious assembly held in the city of Raipur went viral on social media. He was arrested on the charge of promoting enmity between communities, making derogatory remarks against Gandhi and praising his assassin during his speech. The opposition is also demanding the arrest of other Hindu leaders for hate speeches. But will Prime Minister Modi succumb to the pressure ahead of the elections in five states?
It seems the biggest issue the right-wing groups commonly called Sangh Parivar has with Gandhi is that he advocated Hindu-Muslim unity. That's against their conception that Muslims and Christians are an internal threat to the nation. But there is another, probably more serious reason, for their hatred of Gandhi is his challenge to those hardliners who had gone on rampaging following the partition of the country in two, Pakistan and India.
No wonder that Hindu hardliners and BJP leaders make public statements to build a narrative that blames Gandhi for the country's division and other ills. Still, even though it has been more than 7 decades since Gandhi was assassinated, Hindutva forces feel compelled to question his authority. Sadly, the biggest Gandhi-hating segment lies within the Hindus and not outside it, as was seen in a recently held religious assembly. In fact, in today's India, everybody who chooses to abuse Gandhi should have complete freedom of expression, since they have the backing of those ruling the country to pursue their Hindu agenda. The hate speeches of Hindu supremacists are actually an apology for not keeping the country intact, and Gandhi is always their convenient villain. But they are unable to accept the fact that no one is safe and nobody would have a future if they are allowed to go unchecked for making inflammatory speeches and creating a divisive environment.
Now, to have more insight on the story, we are joined by Mr. Sanjeev Kumar, senior researcher on Gandhian philosophy and peace studies. Mr. Kumar, welcome to the program, sir. Let's begin with your thoughts on Gandhi's role in establishing ideas of peaceful coexistence and equality in India.
When you try to understand a personality like Gandhi and his contributions, I think it's very difficult, you know, in the sense that if you try to understand his philosophy, often you see there are a lot of contrasting views on Gandhi. In the popular imagination, people have perceived Gandhi's life and journey in so many different ways. He appears to be a Mahatma, great soul, a very ascetic person who inspired a very revolutionary movement in the country. Well, you see in the current discourse also, in the narratives of the discourse today, and of course, during the pre-colonial period, Gandhi was understood, you know, in a very ambivalent manner by people, you know, of course, with people whom he engaged on a day-to-day basis. If you look at the current works of people like Arundhati Roy, they have targeted Gandhi and has, in fact, went on to, brandish him as a kind of a reactionary, scholar who blustered the caste system. Even during his early stays, if you see in South Africa, he is argued that he held a very derogatory views toward the native communities. And now you see all this, ambivalent or I say critical position that people take on Gandhi are by a selective reading of Gandhi, not in terms of making a true assessment of Gandhi in terms of not only the contributions he has made for the country, largely in the subcontinent, but as a global scholar, I think his ideas, are extremely important when we look at the current, crisis we are undergoing today.
Mr. Kumar, Gandhi's critics today have called him a traitor and praised his assassin, who had the same line of criticism. Now, could this be a way of intensifying extremism?
Yeah, I think so. It is true because as I spoke in the discussions earlier, that Gandhi has an idea of accommodative, inclusive idea of India, that of course rested on a very profound idea of religiosity that Gandhi brings in his worldview. When we try to understand other spectrum the ideas of Hindutva, you have to understand it is based on exclusionary criteria, and that is why there are two different views, or you can say two different spectrums through which where we see India of today is heading towards. One is Gandhi's idea of Hinduism, which brings the idea of inclusive accommodative truth, where there is another idea, pitted idea of Hindutva. Of course, it has gained credence today, not to say that it has not gained popularity, but you have to also see that those people who work in the name of Savarkar's Hindutva do try to refer and go back to Gandhi, because there is no alternative to Gandhi, you have to understand. You know, that is why you see, you know, Gandhi is often brought to the public imaginary, you know, even if it is a ritualistic visit to Rajghat or celebrating or bringing certain activities, you know, in the name of Gandhi.
There you have it, Mr. Sanjeev Kumar from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people reacted on social media on the issue.
A cabinet minister of the government of Maharashtra says an insult to Mahatma Gandhi is an insult to our nation. Strict actions should be taken against Kalicharan and he should be booked for insulting the father of our nation. Indian Congress Party leader Rahul Gandhi reacts on his Twitter to an insult to the father of nation by writing Mahatma Gandhi's own words, quote, "You can chain me, torture me, you can destroy this body, but you cannot imprison my thoughts." An Indian activist posts a Gandhi's picture on his Twitter and says Gandhi, wrapped in his white shawl, sits before a microphone to speak at a prayer meeting in Delhi. It was the second day of his fast on January 14, 1948, for communal peace. He ended his fast on January 18th after being given a pledge of harmony by leaders of different communities.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
The lack of a domestic refugee protection framework has meant that India's recognition and protection of refugees has been inconsistent and subject to political will and motivation. In the absence of a legal mechanism, the country has seen deviating from its obligations to uphold human rights principle. The reason probably is the religion of Rohingyas. Since the controversial Citizenship Act passed by the Narendra Modi-led government in 2019 provided a pathway to citizenship for persecuted minorities from several neighboring countries, unless they are not Muslims.
Anti-Rohingya sentiment and discrimination seem rampant in India since their arrival to save their lives from a state-sponsored persecution in Myanmar. They not only face deplorable conditions, but are increasingly persecuted for the same reason they were in Myanmar, their religion. That's amid anti-Muslim sentiment in the country that has risen since the right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party under Prime Minister Narendra Modi came to power. Over the past few years, the Modi government has introduced controversial policy changes by revoking the semi-autonomous status of the only Muslim-majority state of Kashmir to passing a controversial citizenship law. In due process, Rohingya have become a target as well. Throughout its history, India has accepted refugees fleeing persecution elsewhere, including Tamils, Tibetans, and Afghans. So what has changed now? Of course, there is a change of government with right-wing Hindu groups at the helm. Ironically, Indian rulers cite stateless Rohingya a threat to security, denying them everything they need under international humanitarian laws. Rohingya refugees living in camps in different cities and regions, including Jammu, Hyderabad, Nuh, and the capital New Delhi, many of them believed to be undocumented. Several times, they have witnessed their slums being burnt, with media and officials citing unknown reasons. But the reasons are lucid and clear, as they all go in the backdrop of the lack of a domestic refugee protection framework, and refugees, especially Rohingya, are subject to political will and motivation.
Thank you. The 1951 Refugee Convention clearly states that the asylum state shall not return any refugee to a territory where his life or freedom is endangered due to his race, religion, nationality, or political alignment or opinion. However, India's treatment of Rohingyas has been conspicuously different. In an affidavit filed by the Indian government in the Supreme Court in 2017 on the deportation of Rohingyas, not only called them illegal and infiltrator, but also a threat to security. So the question is, are they really posing a threat to India?
Given that India is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention, it maintains that it has no obligation to provide asylum or be bound by the principle. However, as a signatory to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it owes obligations to uphold human rights principles nonetheless. In the absence of a legal framework, persons from different countries are treated differently, as stipulated in the 2019 controversial legislation of the Modi government. It puts a question mark on a country that wants to get a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. Myanmar's leadership took no heed to the international calls to stop the carnage, with the West's own human rights champion Aung San Suu Kyi facing international ire for being a mute spectator. It was a shameful moment for Suu Kyi to face the International Court of Justice last year over a petition launched by the Gambia against Myanmar, accusing it of violating the 1948 Genocide Convention. Will Suu Kyi or any world leaders with sound minds support what happened to an ethnic community in Myanmar? Answer is mixed, seeing the track record of some countries. India falls into this category given its ill treatment of Rohingya. Even India's Supreme Court sided with a government petition to deport dozens of Rohingya under the pretext of a security threat.
Now to have more insight on the topic, we are joined by Dr. Moang Zani from London, a human rights activist and co-founder of Free Rohingya Coalition. First of all, glad to have you with us, Dr. Zani. As you know, right-wing leaders refer to the Rohingya Muslims as infiltrators. Do you think this is an effort to identify them as a threat to India's national security?
No, this is not an attempt to identify Rohingyas as a threat to national security of India. This is an attempt to frame the Rohingya as a threat. That's different from Rohingyas being identified or being really a threat to national security of India. India is 1 billion people country with one of the world's largest military and intelligence networks. So the Indian, the Rohingyas who fled genocide in Burma and sought refuge in India, they're less than 20,000. That may even be an overestimation. But India's particularly the ruling party BJP that wants to remake India as essentially a country of non-Muslims, primarily Hindus and maybe some Buddhists. They have been using this kind of a threat to national security language over the last 5 years. And I was in New Delhi for a security conference organized by Facebook and one other think tank based in New Delhi, and I share a panel with a BJP member, and also I heard senior officials from the Indian Home Ministry that basically use what I consider and what many genocide scholars would recognize as the language of genocidal killers, that is weak and vulnerable the national or ethnic or religious community, is falsely framed as a threat to national security, a threat to the purity of their religion, what they consider their race. And this is a kind of thing that we heard in the Nazi Germany.
Dr. Zani, with India's record of harboring refugees escaping persecution, do you see any difference in how they treat Rohingya refugees and those of other ethnicities?
Yes, absolutely. You know, if you look at how welcoming India has been, you know, since the 1950s towards anti-China Tibetan refugees, right? It's in the interest of India to give a home to or refuge to those who are opposed to communist China, and but at the same time, you know, the Rohingya refugees are, as I said, just a handful compared to 1 billion total population. It makes absolutely no difference, whether even if the Rohingya refugees were granted, full refugee status with all the legal protections and rights, it would not make any difference in the life of the normal or ordinary Indian, about 1 million. But mind you, the Modi, the BJP Prime Minister, has brought in a rather genocidal laws. If you look at what Modi government has done with respect to almost 2 million Muslims of Assam, with some Bangladeshi ancestry, that they have been stripped of their legal entitlement and rights and protections by the Indian government. The other one is that while the Modi government is treating Muslims in a drastically nasty way, that it has also opened its door towards an non-Muslim, particularly Buddhist and Hindus from other parts of Southeast Asia, especially Nepal and Bhutan and other places. And so that you can see clearly that India's treatment of Rohingya based on their religion, Islam, is radically different from India's treatment of non-Muslims. And so this is religiously and particularly religiously motivated a policy. If you write policies and adopt policies on the basis of religious background of different populations, you're in the realm of what is considered genocidal persecution.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Zani for his precious time and insight. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Founding editor of The Wire, Siddharth, writes on his post that Rohingya in India illegal, a national security threat, the Modi government says, in a court affidavit. The center's affidavit also says that the matter of deportation is best left to the central government's discretion. India's leading newspaper, The Hindu, writes that the plight of tens of thousands of Rohingya Muslims continues in Bangladesh and says 100 babies were born in the no man's land near the border alone. Rick Fuad, attorney and child welfare advocate, says this is the same Aung San Suu Kyi who's mentioned defending genocide against Rohingya. Not that Myanmar junta isn't reprehensible and should be tried at Hague. It's that she should be too. Dr. Fozia Alvi, a physician and human rights advocate, writes on her Twitter that massive fire in Rohingya camps seems that there's no end to their misery.
And that was our episode on Hindu groups insulting India's father of nation, Mahatma Gandhi, and also the Hindu nationalist government's campaign to throw Rohingya refugees out of the country. Thank you for your time, everyone. Take good care.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
In the limelight.
Greenwashing gives ethical cover to colonial Zionist brutality, says Omar Zahzar, writer, in an article published under the heading Greenwashing Provides Cover for Zionist Settler Colonialism. Stay tuned for more. It is a phrase from a longer piece by the Palestinian nationalist poet Mahmoud Darwish that has been frequently cited in stand-alone translation. If the olive trees knew the hands that planted them, their oil would become tears. If the ancient trees were gifted with faculties comparable to those of humans, they would be so overcome by the oppression faced by their indigenous stewards that their biological essence, their life-preserving gifts, would be irreversibly overrun by sorrow and despair. But the olive trees don't only need the gift of empathy to suffer the pains of colonialism. Indeed, if they could bear witness to the insidious cruelty by which the alien Zionist occupiers have weaponized the very earth itself, they would have even more reason to weep. Planting foreign and invasive tree species has been a standard feature of Zionist settler colonialism since the first waves of ethnic cleansing that constitutes the ongoing Nakba began in 1948. The advantages this process poses to the colonizers are at least threefold. It provides a means of concealing Zionist war crimes. It prevents Palestinians from returning to the homes from which they have been forcibly displaced. And of course, it changes the character of the landscape, allowing for the sham Western religious colonial artifice Zionists seek to install over Palestine to take root literally as it were. The Jewish National Fund, or JNF, an outsourced arm of the colonial Zionist regime, has been actively facilitating this process since 1948, cynically fundraising under false pretenses for what they claim are forestation efforts, but in reality amount to providing biological cover for colonial ethnic cleansing. The JNF also provided political, financial, and intellectual support to the rampaging Zionist militias that slaughtered and dispossessed Palestinians during the massacres that laid the foundation for the so-called founding of the Israeli regime. And this process of eco-colonization is not limited to the past. 46 out of 68 JNF parks and forests are directly on top of Palestinian villages. The remainder naturally rests atop stolen land. Canada Park, a project funded by JNF Canada, was built on the destruction and depopulation of three villages, Beit Nuba, Imwas, and Yalu. The JNF is using fast-growing invasive trees to actively displace Palestinians in Al-Naqa. The newly named Forest of Yatir, fully funded by JNF, is planted on top of Attire Village in Al-Naqa, a clear embodiment of the Zionist regime's active campaign to displace the people of Attire deeper into the desert. Hollow appropriation of variously left-wing causes is a stable feature of Zionism, which has reacted parasitically to various freedom movements throughout history in order to better conceal its core purpose of Palestinian genocide. Joseph Massad has shown how Zionists systematically appropriated the language of anti-colonial and civil rights movements in order to rebrand Zionism as continuous with liberation-focused political efforts by making a case for the Zionist regime's non-existent, progressive bona fides. Palestinians are actually aware of this Zionist political pilfering. The environment is no exception. The use of pseudo-environmentalist values to provide a smokescreen for unmitigated settler colonial disposition has a name: greenwashing. Greenwashing gives ethical cover to colonial Zionist brutality. It also provides the rationale by which the JNF and various other pro-colonial Zionist organizations, foundations, and nonprofits enjoy charitable status. This charitable status allows the JNF to provide tax credits for donations, meaning that up to 25% of their budget comes from public tax dollars. In other words, charity is being weaponized to facilitate ethnic cleansing and genocide in real time. For these reasons, it's imperative that all of people living in North America do their utmost to agitate for revocation of the charitable status enjoyed by organizations such as Regavim, the MZ Foundation, and the Hebron Fund. Such organizations that fund the Zionist settler communities, really colonizer communities, are far more apt in Palestine, are able to do so in large part thanks to North American donor funding. Therefore, the Americans share a serious responsibility to bring about an end to this subsidized violence by virtue of location. On Sunday, January 30, PYM Boston led a virtual teaching and action, Hands of Al-Naqab, Hands of Palestine. As the Zionist regime continues to displace Palestinians in Al-Naqab and all of Palestine, it is incumbent upon Americans to reject greenwashing and join the fight to defund racism and stop the JNF. Lest we forget, the narrator of Mahmoud Darwish's identity card also warned the Zionist regime to beware of the